One of every six American families now lives in a multi-generational household, three generations or more under one roof. That's a huge increase over the last few decades. It's a huge change in American life, and it can be a huge financial and emotional challenge for the people living in those households, people we are learning from in a series we call Family Matters. Last week, our Morning Edition colleague David Green introduced us to three families we're following over these weeks, 8 weeks in total. Hi, David.
Hi, Steve.
He's back with us again. And who are we visiting this week?
Well, one of our families, Steve, lives in Capitol Heights, Maryland, and they're dealing with all the pressures that you're talking about. And the first voice you're going to hear is Natasha Shimon Gilmore. She's 58 years old. She works as a computer trainer at a nonprofit, and she lives in one of these multi-generation households. She lives with her husband, also her 24-year-old son, and her father, Franklin Brunson. Now, he had been living in North Carolina until about 2 years ago, and that's when Natasha got this anonymous phone call that really changed her life.
Someone called me and said, "Hi, you don't know me. Are you Mr. Brunson's daughter?" I said, "Yes, I am." They said, "Your dad's in trouble." And I was like, "Oh, okay." And I immediately packed up and went to North Carolina.
And so, Steve, she found her father totally confused, an elderly man, his finances in disarray. And Natasha realized at that moment that she had to move him back home with her to Maryland.
It doesn't sound like this is something the family was expecting.
It wasn't something they were expecting at all. I mean, they were totally unprepared. You know, Natasha lives in this cramped two-bedroom house. There wasn't really room to move her elderly father in, so the family had a friend put up this makeshift drywall in the middle of the living room to create a bedroom for him.
So he's living with them now, and I suppose they were hoping that he could be reasonably self-sufficient.
Reasonably, but that hasn't turned out to be the case. So Franklin Brunson, he's 81 years old, and he has dementia, and it's just gotten worse and worse. He's also a man who's partially blind. And last winter, the family just had this awful scare. Mr. Brunson was kind of having a bad day. He wanted to escape the house, and he took off with Natasha, his daughter's car, and he went missing, Steve, for 2 days.
He ended up on the wrong side of the road, driving up and down on black ice, and residents called the state troopers, and the state troopers got him and put the car to the side.
And so, Steve, Franklin Brunson did make it home okay, but, I mean, you can just imagine how frightening this was. It was, of course, a real turning point. Natasha realized that she just couldn't leave her dad alone anymore. And I met Natasha. She's this tall, elegant woman. She was in a business suit the morning we spoke, ready to go to her full-time job. She loves her father so much, but you can just feel the stress that she's feeling right now.
So in the morning, my head's spinning because I'm thinking of all things that have to be done. And it's a lot, anyway.
And so, Steve, one decision that she made, one thing that she did, was she decided to put her father in an adult day center during the day. It was an emotional decision, but if she was going to keep working full-time, she had to find a place for her father to go. And we really wanted to understand what a place like this is like, and also how much it costs. I mean, this is an expensive decision for a family. And so we went along with Natasha's dad, Franklin Brunson, to the Crescent Ridge Adult Day Center outside Washington, D.C.
Good morning.
Mr. Brunson, hello.
I'm fine. How you doing?
I'm doing great now that I see you.
The several dozen residents who spend their days here suffer from dementia, Alzheimer's, or various brain injuries. Now, when we spent some time with Franklin Brunson early in the morning at his daughter's house, he seemed antsy, really quiet. He spent most of the time staring blankly. But his energy and personality burst out during the day. A few minutes after Natasha drops him off, Brunson is holding court at a round table in the center's sun-splashed main room. I asked him about something I'd heard, that he was one heck of a bowler.
I hear you're the bowling champion.
No, I'm not a bowling champion. If I was, I wouldn't be sitting here.
Brunson and his friends spend hours talking about whatever happens to be on their minds. Today, it's death. They were chatting about musicians who've died young, like Whitney Houston.
Did she have to die? Why she died earlier? We don't know. At least that's what I was telling her. I do not know.
Brunson wasn't just thinking about the untimely death of a singer. He was reflecting on the clock running out on his own life.
That was her time. Her time would go, not mine.
These kinds of interactions are no accident. One of the goals of adult day centers is to keep the mind working. And we wanted to talk about that with the director here.
Hi, how you doing?
Corey O'Dall is the psychologist who directs Crescent Ridge, and he says the care here is more meaningful if families catch dementia or Alzheimer's early.
This is usually the right option when it's early diagnosis, when we're realizing that mom and dad can no longer stay at home, when we're realizing that they need social oversight, when they need supervision, when they need medical oversight.
This decision about how to care for an elderly parent when a disease like dementia sets in is one facing more and more people.
Years ago, elderly parents didn't live as long as they do today.
And the fact that people are living longer puts more financial pressures on the people caring for them. Attending Crescent Ridge costs $78 a day. It's pretty typical for adult day centers like this. Medicaid will cover some or all of the cost. Families who don't qualify for Medicaid often come for a tour of Corey's adult day center and then leave, realizing they just can't afford the cost out of pocket. But financial pressures aside, the emotion Corey often sees when a new family comes in is confusion.
There are people that will walk into the door and say, I don't know what to do. All I know is that I need help with my mom or my dad or my grandmother or my grandfather.
And help can mean many different things.
Okay, we're gonna eat. You ready to eat?
Yum, yum.
Okay. One of the other families we're following lives here in an apartment south of Baltimore. They, too, are caring for a loved one with dementia, and they've made an entirely different choice. Yolanda Hunter says her family never considered an adult day center for her grandmother.
They let them sit, they'll give them their lunch, and then that's it. So it's extremely expensive, but you're not paying for quality.
Quality care is what Yolanda says she gives her grandmother personally. Right, 2 years ago, she quit her job to become a full-time caregiver. She spends every day with her grandmother, Ida Christian.
Sing your favorite song.
What is my favorite song?
Okay, I'm going to say the first couple words. It's your thing. Do what you want to do.
It's your thing. Do what you want to do. I can't tell you who to talk it to. Oh, it's your thing. Blah, blah, blah.
And so, Steve, I've just been hearing a lot of touching moments like these.
That's NPR's David Greene. And, David, as people are listening, I'm sure there are many, many people, maybe millions of people hearing this story who can directly relate to it in their own lives. Is there some place that people can go to share their stories or even find each other?
Yeah, and I mean, that is really one of the things we want to do with this series, make it a real conversation. And listeners who are hearing these stories, they can go to our Morning Edition Facebook page and certainly share their stories and experiences.
You can also go to NPR.org, where you can find pictures of the three families David is following. David, we'll talk to you again next week.
Sounds good, Steve.
Even before the U.S. financial crisis, Detroit was known for having undervalued real estate. Now a bad situation is even worse. The median Detroit home price in 2011 was about $54,000. That's more than $100,000 less than the national average. Sometimes in Detroit, housing prices don't seem to make much sense at all. NPR's Sonari Glinton reports.
If you were rich and important and lived in Detroit, at some time you probably lived in Detroit's Boston Edison neighborhood. Think Berry Gordy or Henry Ford. Both Motown moguls called the neighborhood home. With its tree-lined streets and its Tudor Revival mansions, it looks like it could be any wealthy neighborhood. Think Greenwich, Connecticut, or Beverly Hills. Hello.
Sorry about the glove.
Annette Foreman and her brother, Michael Bradley, have spent the last several months cleaning their mother's home. She died Christmas Eve last year.
Michael! We have visitors!
The house they now have up for sale is the home that was originally built for Walter O. Briggs in 1915. Briggs was in the car business. His company built auto bodies, and he owned the Detroit Tigers. Michael Bradley agreed to show me around.
This is a two-part kitchen. There's this part of this kitchen, and then there's this part, which is the butler's pantry. The room that we were just in is the working kitchen. Those ovens down there, about 15, 20 feet away, those are actually little warmers for plates.
This four-story house has about 10,000 square feet. There's a room just for linens. There's an elevator, a solarium, a cold closet for fur coats. Bradley and Foreman's parents bought the house in 1976 for about $65,000. They filled their home with collectibles, and they enjoyed entertaining.
So, and what would this room be used for?
Ballroom.
This is the ballroom. You are standing in the ballroom. Mm-hmm. You want a two-step, or you want a waltz?
I assume the band would be over here somewhere. Oh, the band would be, that's the bandstand.
Yes.
Right. Oh.
Yes.
Oh.
Up here is where the band would be.
Little did they know, but behind the doors were walk-in safes.
That is an actual bank vault. And right there is the silver vault for the house. That's where you would lock up all your silver.
So what do you think all that costs? Stained glass windows, servants' quarters, a coach house, all that on one of Detroit's most historic streets, well, it'll run you less than about $450,000. A comparable home in Silicon Valley is selling for $15 million. Walter Maloney is with the National Association of Realtors. He says the Bradley family is facing the same problems that millions of Americans are.
This is perhaps an extreme example of a home being worth really a mere fraction of what it would cost you to build that property. In fact, in most of the country today, we are seeing homes selling for less than replacement construction costs. And this is really an overcorrection of the housing boom and bust cycle.
In 2000, the Bradley family had the home appraised, and at the time, it was worth $1.5 million. The question for them now is, why sell now? Bradley and his siblings are all underwater on their own homes.
We have homes of our own that we can't get rid of because of their upside downness. And we don't, you know, I'll be quite honest, this is not a cheap house to run utility-wise.
For Annette Foreman, there's a lot more at stake than the price tag.
I'm going to miss it from the historical point of view. You know, to have something that is a living antique, I'm going to miss
dinners and things that we had here. We had
baking
a lot of,
in the kitchen with my mother. My mother and I, for the holidays, would start baking in October. This was a part of my mom.
Annette Foreman and her brother Michael Bradley say they're looking for someone who wants to take care of the home. They don't just want a buyer who's looking for a sweet deal. They say they've already turned those people away. Sonara Englinton, NPR News.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Boston is getting the country's first commercial route flown by the new Boeing 787 Dreamliner. Now, the flight lifts off tomorrow afternoon. Nonstop service from Boston to Tokyo. The Japan Airlines flight will give a lift to Boston's economy, with Japanese tourists and business travelers now just 13 hours away. From member station WBUR in Boston, Kurt Nickisch reports on the city's nonstop excitement.
From Boston's airport, it's just a five-minute cab ride to the North End, an Italian-American neighborhood of pizzerias, pastry shops, and sidewalk cafes.
Di Pasquale, Frank Di Pasquale. Right now you're at my gelateria.
Di Pasquale also owns high-end restaurants, a bakery, and a seafood bar in the North End. He was born in Italy, in the shadow of Mount Vesuvius. Now he's preparing for an influx of customers from the shadow of Mount Fuji.
I did a menu that is written in Japanese. I'm giving them the food that they really love, which is the fresh oysters, all these cold water oysters from the Northeast.
Di Pasquale has added more seafood dishes, crab, ceviche, and raw fish. He heard that many Japanese turn up their noses at American-sized meals, so he's added smaller menu items.
A dish of pasta that is absolutely not overflowing on the dish, not that extra sauce flooded in sauce. I mean, we're trying to give them a dish that they would eat in their own home country.
Boston restaurants are not the only ones planning to serve a boost in Japanese visitors.
Good afternoon. Thank you for calling the front desk. This is Kelly.
At the Westin Copley Place Hotel, marketing manager Perry Kessler has been running cultural boot camps for employees.
Whether it's, you know, the reading of a business card, bowing, there are certain numbers that may be thought to bring bad luck.
The hotel has hired Japanese speakers to help guests get Red Sox tickets and figure out where to shop.
Everything in Japan is so expensive.
Shoko Hirao is a Japan native who's been advising local businesses how to cash in on this new wave of high-spending visitors.
Average is, I think, $3,800 per person for five-night stay.
Hirao has helped outlet malls print international sizing charts. She's told Boston's many museums to call themselves a national treasure to draw more Japanese tourists. But it's the potential for corporate travelers that has Boston business leader Tim Rowe excited about the city's first ever nonstop flight to Asia.
If you don't have a direct flight, then the foreign company would never consider even a regional headquarters here.
Rowe says the new Japan Airlines flight makes Boston now 1.5 hours closer to Tokyo door-to-door than New York City. For NPR News, I'm Kurt Nickisch in Boston.
This is NPR News.